From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about the Ronin Chamber Ensemble's new season.
I'll get a preview of Ken Burns' new documentary on the Dust Bowl.
And I get to meet Tanya Moskalenko, the new president and CEO of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For nearly three decades, the musicians of the Ronin Chamber Ensemble have been performing small ensemble pieces for mixed winds and strings. Sharon Gamble invited co-founder David Bellman, who's also the longtime principal clarinetist for the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, to our studios to hear more about the first two concerts of Ronin's new season.
So it's kind of a movable feast with this year's season. You're going to be many places, not just the Woodroom.
Yes, that's true. I think this is the first year we've actually been in four different venues for each concert, and usually we're a couple of times in the Woodroom, which is where we have been on and off since 1984-85.
No, it's been that long?
It has.
Yikes,
been that long.
Okay.
This is our 29th season. We're almost over the hill now. So, yes. We're going to help inaugurate the newly renovated sanctuary at IHC. We will have a concert in the Woodroom in January, and then we'll have a University of Indianapolis Crystal DeHaan Center concert, and our annual collaboration with the Indianapolis Violin Competition in April at the History Center, the Frank and Katrina Bazile Theater.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about specifics of the concerts, but when you and Ingrid were starting this out with some of your friends 29 years ago, did you ever think, oh, we'll still be doing this in almost three decades?
I probably wasn't thinking that at the time. I didn't know what I'd be doing in three decades, but it's quite nice that we have been able to continue it, and we've covered such wonderful repertoire and been able to play with a large variety of different guest artists, and it's just been a terrific ride.
And you haven't played everything that you want to play yet.
No, that is definitely true, and I've been trying to give a little thought for that 30th year of some of the things, but we'll keep that a mystery for now.
Yeah, cross that bridge when you come to it. For now, I love this idea of helping to inaugurate the new sanctuary, which is gorgeous, at the IHC. And you're collaborating with an old friend, cantor Janice Roger. Tell us about her role in this first concert on December 10th.
Well, she'll be serving both as narrator but also as singer. We're doing a really cool piece by living composer David Schiff, which is called Divertimento on Gimple the Fool. Gimple the Fool is a folk tale written by Isaac Bashevis Singer, and it's about a fellow who is repeatedly humiliated by the townsfolk, but his innocence transcends their cruelty over time. And
aww,
it's an interesting story that takes in a lot of details of Jewish life, and it has a very klezmer mood about it, although Schiff tells us in his program notes that he wasn't trying to duplicate the klezmer sound, but he was actually trying to reconstruct the sound of this music from from the traces it left in works of Mahler and Stravinsky and Kurt Weill. So like
wow.
you might hear in the Mahler's First Symphony,
yeah,
there's
yeah.
some klezmer-sounding moments.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting piece, and in that, as I mentioned, Cantor Roger will narrate.
Does the clarinet play the role of Gimple, the innocent?
No,
it's not quite that programmatic.
No, but as I said, there is a... There's an interesting instrumentation, which is like the Quartet for the End of Time by Messiaen. It's the violin, clarinet, cello, and piano.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the David Schiff did originally write an opera on this tale, and this is a divertimento that he put together. He wrote it originally for the Chamber Music Northwest people out in Oregon.
And the Prokofiev seems like a fitting choice.
Yes, this is, overture on Hebrew themes, and this is a number that we have played on a few occasions, and always a favorite of ours and the audience. In this case, he is using, I believe, some actual folk melodies and elaborating on them in this for clarinet, string quartet, and piano. And we've had the pleasure of meeting and working with a young pianist in Indianapolis named Gregory Martin, and he will be playing with us on this, as well as myself and Ingrid and Phil Palermo and Nancy Agris, and a second violinist still to be named.
Uh-huh. Work in progress. And I should note that we're having this conversation a few weeks before the concert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that concert is on December 10th. It's a Monday evening. We do alternate this year between Mondays and Tuesdays. This one, our first concert, will be Monday evening at 7:30. And at the Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation, which is at 6501 North Meridian.
Beautiful, beautiful space and good acoustic. It's a big hall.
Yeah, it is.
Hall. Sorry, I mean no disrespect, but it is a big space that seats many hundreds of people. Yeah.
Yes.
And shifting gears, you're doing something new. You're launching a new educational program with your January concert. It's essentially, if I'm understanding it correctly, it's a chamber music version of the ISO's
side-by-side
concerts.
Yes. We're calling the concert Young Masters and, well, actually, it's...
Masterpieces
and Young Masters.
Yeah, smart.
And the Young Master in this case is a young, still high school oboist named Weitzu Chu, who we call Gene Chu, and I've had the pleasure of hearing her on a number of occasions, including in our side-by-side concert with the ISO, and in her role also in the New World Youth Symphony here in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
She's currently doing her senior year in school at the Interlochen Arts Academy up in Michigan, and she's going to make a special effort to be down here in January for our concert. And, we actually did this one time before, and coincidentally enough, it was with an oboist who did end up actually originally as second oboist of the Chicago Symphony. Now he's their English horn player. And so we hope that Jean Chu will have equal success in her future career.
But you're a launching pad.
She's a wonderful young player, and we're looking forward to collaborate with her in a reed trio by Mio.
Who doesn't get heard nearly enough?
I would agree, and the piece in this case was Suite After Corette, and it's inspired by the music of Michel Corette, 18th century French composer. And it was actually used originally as some incidental music to a French staged version of Romeo and Juliet.
Wow.
So it's kind of an interesting mix of both some folk sounds and some Renaissance type of music. And we're also featuring another young, she's a little further on her way in her career, but another young musician named Aretha Jura, who's currently a member of the Lincoln Center Chamber Players 2 group, which is their program for up-and-coming artists, but they're performing at Lincoln Center just as the senior members. And Aretha is a wonderful violinist who I've had the chance to work with a little bit already, and we're joining my husband and wife team. We're going to also be working with her husband and wife, or wife and husband team, and we'll be collaborating both with Aretha and with Alexei Zakharov, who is our acting second bassoonist in the ISO, and we'll play together in a serenata by Casella for the second work on that concert. Alexei will also work with me and Jean Chu in the Mio trio to begin the concert. Mm-hmm. One of our unifying themes this year with our concerts is that all three of our concerts, other than the one at the IHC, will be featuring a great work by Brahms, and Aretha and Ingrid and once again Gregory Martin, pianist, will be playing the Brahms Trio Opus 8 for the finale of this concert.
Sharon Gamble with David Bellman, co-founder with his wife, ISO cellist Ingrid Fisher Bellman of the Ronin Chamber Ensemble. Learn more about the concerts that they were talking about at roninchamber.org, and that's spelled R-O-N-E-N, chamber.org, roninchamber.org.
Listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Ken Burns' new PBS documentary on the Dust Bowl debuts November 18th and 19th. Travis DiNicola invited Gary Edgerton, the new dean of Butler University's College of Communication, to visit The Art of the Matter to chat about Burns' new work. Edgerton is the author of Ken Burns America, the first book-length study to comprehensively examine the filmmaker. He's also the co-executive editor of the Journal of Popular Film and Television.
Gary, welcome to Art of the Matter. Thank you for coming to our studio.
Glad to be here, Travis.
And welcome to Indianapolis as the new dean of Butler's College of Communications. I know you've only been here since this summer. Welcome to Butler, welcome to Indianapolis, and of course, welcome to FYI.
Oh, well, thanks so much. I've enjoyed it so far.
Well, very good, very good. And great to be able to have a chance to have you on now, very appropriately enough, right before the broadcast of Ken Burns' The Dust Bowl. You're a bit of a Ken Burns expert. I know that your book, Ken Burns America, came out in 2001, sort of a history of the filmmaker of history, if you will.
Right.
And you've also recently had a chance to preview The Dust Bowl. And I know you've written a review of that. You got to see it before the rest of us did. Before we jump into talking about The Dust Bowl, though, let me just ask you this. What is it that, for you as a communications professor, what is it that fascinates you about Ken Burns?
I mean, there's so much that I first became interested because he has now become normative for his generation of filmmakers. But going back to when the Brooklyn Bridge first came out in 1981, 1982, there was really no one making documentaries like him, that the kinds of techniques that he used, you know, had existed before, but he put them together in a, you know, such a unique combination that, you know, he really, I've always been interested in nonfiction film, mm-hmm. and, you know, so the documentary in general, but it was clear from the very beginning that this was a very talented storyteller.
You know, I totally forgot about the Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, of course, you know, people think of the Civil War and baseball and jazz and so many other, you know, great documentaries that he's put together. But the list just goes on and on. I mean, quite a breath.
Absolutely, 22 of them. When I wrote the book, I was in Hampton Roads at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, and all of his papers and films were down the University of North Carolina. And, you know, going into the box on the Brooklyn Bridge, I really got a sense of the tenacity of him as a filmmaker, that it really took him 4 or 5 years. He wasn't established. There was no one to fund him. And, you know, by hook and crook and working with David McCullough, you know, the great popular historian, he produced this film and it was nominated for an Academy Award.
What is it that you think makes history so accessible through Ken Burns' work? I mean, obviously, he's even though academics certainly, you know, enjoy him, I mean, his great appeal is that it is this popularization of history. As you mentioned, McCullough is a great writer of that. But what is it about Burns' style that allows people to be drawn in so easily?
I mean, the fact that he is a storyteller. And I think he's learned a lot about storytelling at the very beginning of his career through David McCullough. Mm-hmm. That if you read David McCullough's books, you know, they create great characters that the usual strategies of telling a story, building dramatic conflict and resolution, those kinds of things, he uses through all of his films. And in that way, it brings in not only the professional historian, but the popular audience as well.
I can't even imagine what it takes for Ken Burns to create one of his documentaries. I mean, sorting through probably, you know, thousands, if not possibly millions of photographs and information, you know, all the information that's available to him. But the photographs alone, that just seems daunting to me.
I mean, absolutely. And you know, when you talk about the Civil War, really his masterwork, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands of photographs. Mm-hmm. You know, today Ken Burns is, you know, not only the individual himself, the filmmaker, but it sort of is code for, you know, a production company.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, Ken
style,
Burns is
aesthetic,
a brand.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he's working on 5 films at once. He has, mm-hmm. you know, up in Walpole, New Hampshire, where he has his production facility, has 40 people working for him. So, mm-hmm. you know, different producers are working on projects, doing research, and he's very much involved too. But if you go back from the very beginning, he used to do this with just himself and, you know, one or two other people who he was working with, and he developed a style and a working process, and now he's brought a lot of other people into that process.
I'm here with Gary Edgerton, the new dean of Butler University's College of Communications. Gary, you recently have published a review of the new documentary of Ken Burns, The Dust Bowl, which is going to be airing soon on WFYI. What'd you think of it?
I liked it a great deal.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's like his other films, mm-hmm. and in other ways, it's a little bit different. When you look at Burns, you see a number of different themes, and he has a handful of films that's really, focused on America, the place, and and the land, and what it symbolizes, going back to Lewis and Clark and Horatio's Drive about the, first road trip across America. And he just did the miniseries on the national parks.
Right.
And all of those really, in a sense, there's ups and downs. There's, positive elements of the story, and then there are tragic elements. And but this with the Dust Bowl is really the first time that he, looks at a natural disaster. And I've always, from school, known about the Dust Bowl, and as most people have, and read about it. But to tell you the truth, I found this documentary a revelation.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, you're a professor of communications, not necessarily of history, and so in watching this, did you find yourself? I mean, it sounds like you found yourself learning.
A great deal.
Yes.
And what I learned was I assumed, I knew who Woody Guthrie was, mm-hmm. and, it was attached to that, and the idea of Okies and people from Oklahoma sort of migrating to California. But the fact that the Dust Bowl lasted almost a decade, from 1931 to 1939, the ferocity and the intensity of the storms was a real surprise that, these dust storms were like tornadoes going across the prairie on their side, and they literally changed the entire landscape. And, it was not only in Oklahoma, but it was in Kansas, Colorado, and Texas. And what it did was it was man-made in the sense that the land was used for decades to grow wheat, and there was no conservation methods being used. And it's really a two-part documentary, where the first part of the documentary, and it's an old traditional style for documentary, the problem is established that this happened, and you really get it through the beauty of this documentary. Are the witnesses that he's, there's probably about two dozen on screen, and they're all in their 80s and their 90s.
Wow.
And they talk about their personal remembrances as though it happened yesterday.
Sure.
And it really brings it alive for us as viewers.
Now, this will air on Sunday, November 18th and Monday, November 19th at 8 p.m. on WFYI1. There's two parts to it, as you said. And the first part sort of presents the problem. The second part is that really where the stories sort of come together? Or
actually, there's a solution, to it, because mm-hmm. We don't have the Dust Bowl again today to the level and degree. And the reason is the FDR and the alphabet soup of all the New Deal programs, some of those programs went to this area, and they, basically gave jobs to the farmers, so they didn't go under. 25% of the population did leave, mm-hmm. and it was actually the greatest migration in American history. But the ones who did stay, they kept them afloat. FDR himself went to the area a couple of times, and what they did too is they taught the farmers there conservation methods, so this wouldn't happen over and over again.
From a communication standpoint, that's a lot of great information about the history of the time period. But from a communication standpoint, as you were watching this, was there ever a moment for you where you thought, oh, that's something I've never seen Ken Burns do before, or something that you would sort of highlight for viewers to pay attention to?
Yeah, I may not be the person to ask that question, because I've actually, because I've done a book on Ken mm-hmm. Burns, I've seen everything that he's done, and I've seen most of what he's done more than once.
Sure.
What I would say is that what is unique in being this familiar with his work is how much, the Ken Burns style has become codified now, where a lot of people use it. And there are certain elements that are part of it. And one of those elements, the most obvious is re-photographing photographs.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the elements is having witnesses, whether it is experts that are talking about a historical period, or people who actually lived through it. And the heart and soul of this particular documentary, more so than even the war, are really these witnesses, and they are really just so compelling, so unselfconscious on camera as they tell their stories. And, and the way that he edits it together, of course, he's shooting many more witnesses or interviewees than he uses, you know, so it's really great footage that's there, and he molds it along with his editors into a narrative style. But I would say, you know, what is distinctive about this is how dependent the Dust Bowl really is on the people who lived it and now recount 80 years later what it was like as if it happened yesterday.
Let me ask you this, because as the Dean of Communications at Butler and as a professor, do you have an opportunity to chat with students at Butler about Ken Burns? And is he relevant to them as well?
I haven't yet, simply because I haven't, taught a class.
I know it's all very new for you here.
Exactly. And I haven't taught a class, and I will at some point on the documentary tradition. But to answer your question, I have noticed over the years where, Ken Burns, when the Civil War came out and then baseball came out, that he was very much the cutting edge of what the documentary is was at that time. You talked about made allusion to his relationship with historians. Then, in fact, in his first eight films before the Civil War, historians lauded him because someone was paying attention and, in fact, popularizing. It became a little bit more problematic when the Civil War came out because some historians thought he was stealing their thunder, which of course wasn't his intention. But now he is very much the establishment in the documentary area. So in that way, students are interested, especially students who are interested in the documentary. But where, it's the widespread popularity where improbably a documentary filmmaker became a household name.
Right.
that kind of interest simply isn't as strong as it was before. Mm-hmm. That it's more settled into, something more normal where he is the most prominent producer for public television. And public television, most of its programming, really is identified as is the programming here for the local audience and that kind of thing. And there are very few programs that can grab a national audience. His specials, Nova, and, all of the great flagship series, The American Experience, are examples of that.
Gary, I want to thank you very much for coming into Art of the Matter today, and pleasure to have a chance to chat with you, and looking forward to having you come back again sometime soon.
Same here, Travis. Thanks so much for having me.
Travis DiNicola with Gary Edgerton, the new dean of Butler University's College of Communication. Edgerton recently published a review of Ken Burns' upcoming documentary, The Dust Bowl, at Critical Studies in Television, CSTOnline.tv. Once again, CSTOnline.tv. More information about Edgerton can be found at his website, GaryEdgerton.com. And Ken Burns' The Dust Bowl will debut on WFYI on November 18th and 19th at 8 p.m. Travis, do you remember what the measurement is for the onions that go in the famous cranberry relish that we always hear on Morning Edition?
Mama Stamberg's?
Yeah, Mama Stamberg's cranberry relish.
No,
it's that... that strange shade of pink it ends up.
Right, kind of like Pepto-Bismol.
Yeah, I might have to go online and find that out because, that special day
is coming up,
and it's time to shop. But don't just work on your Thanksgiving feast. Take a break and do one of our lovely arts events on our calendar we call What'll We Do?
That's right. And be thankful.
Thankful edition.
Hey, not something really to do, but just a shout out that's kind of cool because an Indianapolis student has been selected as a finalist in the fur-free design contest. That's right. It's part of the Humane Society of the United States, and the Art Institute has sponsored the Cool versus Cruel Fashion Design Competition. An Indianapolis resident, Hannah Jones, a student in the Bachelor of Science in Fashion Design program, is representing the Art Institute of Indianapolis in the 8th annual Cool versus Cruel Design Competition, which is taking place coming up very soon. And I just thought that was kind of fun.
That is very fun.
Yes.
I love that.
So, good luck, Anna.
There you go. And I have something if you'd like to get in the mood for the Thanksgiving feast. It's an all-American concert of music by the Philharmonic Orchestra of Indianapolis this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Athenaeum Theater. The theme of the concert is actually American Personalities. Orsina Smith is conducting pieces by Joseph Schwantner, Aaron Copland, Charles Ives, Alan Hovhaness, and Leonard Bernstein. So a wide variety of contemporary American orchestral voices there. There's also the chance to meet with the conductor, Orsina Smith, at 2:30. The concert's at 3. You can meet the conductor at 2:30 for a free listen and learn session. So if you have a little person in your life, a grade school or middle school or high school aged kid, you might consider showing up at 2:30 before the concert and finding out more. So again, that's this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Athenaeum Theater, the Philharmonic Orchestra of Indianapolis. Go to philharmonicindy.org for more information on that.
And this Saturday, Arteek is taking place. It's presented by Partnerships for Lawrence out in Lawrence, Saturday the 17th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Benjamin Harrison YMCA on Lee Road. And they are going to have a whole bunch of juried artists who've been part of the Arts Center out in Lawrence. You can get more information at lawrenceartscenter.net. But holiday gifts and also health and wellness vendors and food trucks and entertainment. And Santa is going to be there from noon to 3. It's an early appearance for Santa, but why not?
He's busy. He's warming up to his role. He's easing into it gradually. Hey, if you happen to be going over the river and through the woods to the southern part of the state, you can take in an artsy fish and aquarium show. Artsy fish.
Ooh, artsy
I'm
fish.
Just saying. You being a fisherman might appreciate this, Travis. Mm-hmm. This is on view at the Switzerland County Visitor Center, which is at 128 West Main Street in Vivi, Indiana. It's on view through December 9th, and it actually features wood, paper mache, clay, repurposed tennis shoe,
wow,
dried flour, and other mediums, all formed for fish. I'm just saying, just to be fish.
I want to check that out.
Artsy Fish and Aquarium Show, Vivi, Indiana. Just saying. Okay. Well, you know, it's by the water, so they have the fish.
I've got another Santa update here.
What?
Yes, that's true. Santa's actually going to be racing to bring the Jolly Days into the Children's Museum of Indianapolis.
Is he going down the slide?
Even earlier than ever, because he's going to be showing up there. Apparently, he's driving a 2012 Honda Civic Coupe that he's going to be showing up at the Children's Museum the day after Thanksgiving on November 23rd at 9 a.m. And, of course, this is a big part of Christmas and the holidays at the Children's Museum. Apparently, Santa's a big fan of IndyCar racing, and so they're going to be tying it in with that as well. And, of course, there's also the Jolly Days Winter Wonderland and Magic Snowman and Breakfast with Santa and all types of great stuff that go on throughout the holidays at the Children's Museum. But if you want to see Santa when he gets to, or Mr. Kringle, as I suppose it's properly said, when he gets to the Children's Museum, it's 9 a.m. on the day after Thanksgiving.
Okay. Well, back to the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. It's a tradition for Indie Folk Series on the Saturday after Thanksgiving, open mic night. This year it benefits the IPS Music Program. And pros can try out new material. Aspiring performers get a stage and a warm reception. If you're thinking about performing on Saturday, November 24th at 7 o'clock, if you're thinking about performing, arrive at 6 o'clock to sign up. And that way you'll know when you're on deck on open mic night at Indie Folk Series, where at the UUI Church, that's Unitarian Universalist Church of Indianapolis, 615 West 43rd Street. So break out your guitar, your harmonica, and your harmonies, and it's for a good cause. Benefits the IPS music programs.
That's a great program.
Yeah.
Awesome. Hey, here's another, this is not a Santa sighting, but maybe something that Well, I don't know. Maybe someone would want to, I'm sure, sit on his lap as well. But John Legend is going to be performing at IU. They just announced this Friday, December 7th, 8 p.m. He is an absolute fantastic performer and great entertainer.
And easy
great
on the
live
eyes.
Concert, easy on the eyes. I'm sure my wife would love to have John Legend in her stocking or something. So if maybe an early holiday gift, go check out John Legend at IU.
I'm sorry, I just wasn't expecting that. Well, gee, one good turn deserves another. Victoria Clark, who's pretty easy on the eyes as well, is performing this Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock as part of Cabaret at the Columbia Club, where, well, surprise, at the Columbia Club. And she has a wide career. She's a Tony Award winner. She's starred on Broadway. She's going to bring standards from the Great American Songbook. Just a lovely, versatile performer with a great stage presence. And I have one more thing I want to give everybody a heads up on, also Cabaret at the Columbia Club related, because this one's probably going to sell quickly. Fortunately, they have four dates for it. It's Martinis and Mistletoe featuring Everett Green, Shannon Forsell, and the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra. You hear them every week on our credits. BWJO and Everett Green and Shannon Forsell. Martinis and Mistletoe, you buy the martini, they supply the mistletoe at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club, 7:30 on December 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th. So four back-to-back nights. Okay. But go to thecabaret.org and check that out soon.
I will get my tickets now.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, an art exhibit definitely worth checking out at Editions Limited Gallery. It's opening on Friday, November 16th, and it is running through actually the end of the year, December 29th. It's titled Midwestern Perspectives, and it's spotlighting the work of 9 Midwestern artists who've recently been honored in the book 100 Artists of the Midwest by Ashley Rooney. And so these artists, who include Brock Kagan, William Chill, Karen Glanders, Gayla Hodson, Abigail Israelin, Mike Kelly, Kenneth Ryden, Stephanie Standish, and Nina Weiss are all showing at Editions Limited Gallery in Broad Ripple. Worth checking out.
Excellent. Hey, if you have family coming in this week or next week for Thanksgiving and you want to show them some local art, you have so many choices, but in particular, I'm going to recommend that you think about going to IRT to see The House That Jack Built, the world premiere play by James Still, set at, surprise, Thanksgiving. Funny and bittersweet and poignant. I liked your review on Facebook, Travis.
I think it's a great play, worth seeing, especially this time of year.
Excellent. Runs through November 25th, so you want to go to irtlive.com fairly soon and check on ticket availability for that.
Always a fun thing to see a play that's having a world premiere by a living playwright. What a great thing.
Yeah.
Hey, some really interesting concerts going on at the ISO in the next couple days. I mean, this weekend you've got ISO presenting the West Side Story music from the movie all weekend long. And then Kenny G is coming on November 20th, Sharon. Do you have your tickets yet?
He's going to be performing
with the ISO. Special performance. Okay. Tickets are going fast.
Okay. I'm sure it'll be fantastic.
Hey,
it'll be a lot of fun.
Kenny G fans are very excited right now.
Kenny G fans are very excited. That's true. It's a good thing we're all a little different or the world would be very dull.
Exactly.
I'm moving on. The Butler Ballet version of The Nutcracker opens Thursday, November 29th, runs through Sunday, December 2nd. It's a family holiday tradition. You can let your little one dance in the aisle, but not too vigorously, please, to the Waltz of the Flowers and think about the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Nutcracker Prince and all the other amazing characters who appear in The Nutcracker, the great traditional ballet at Butler, Thursday, November 29th through Sunday, December 2nd.
Very good. Well, Sharon, I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And we will be back next week. In fact, a broadcast on Turkey Day.
On Thanksgiving, yeah.
That calendar that we call.
No lefters.
No,
leftovers, right?
No leftovers. On
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel recently hired its second permanent president and CEO. Sharon Gamble invited Tanya Castroverde-Moscalento in to learn about how the new center's leader became an arts administrator and why she plans to move her staff around.
So on the day we're having this conversation, welcome to Northern Winters. You've been working your way north.
I sure have, and thank you for that. I actually don't think it's too bad yet, but I have been told to brace myself.
We were lucky. Last year was very mild, so maybe that will be the new pattern.
I sure hope so.
And you know what? With your new job, you're not going to be outdoors much anyway. You're going to be working 24/7. You already are.
Well, that's probably true. And it's funny because over dinner the other night, I was saying to somebody, I said, you know, I'm not afraid of the new job. I'm not afraid of the challenges, of the finances, of the politics. I'm very afraid of winter. So that's the biggest, I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for me.
That might be how you proved that you were the right person for the job, actually. So how did you get involved in performing arts in the first place, and how did you get attracted to the, well, people think it's glamorous on the administrative side, and some days it is, but most days it's not all that glamorous. How did you get called to the administrative side of performing arts?
You know, it's a great question. I think that today things are a little bit different than they used to be 20 or 30 years ago. And for those of us of a certain age, when we were growing up, there weren't things like arts administration courses in college and universities. So I think that most of us that are in this field sort of fell upon this field because we loved the arts in one way or another as performers or as artists. And that was certainly the case with me. My background is as a dancer. And from the age of 10, I have danced. And so it was my passion. And I have been a dancer, a choreographer, a dance educator, a dance advocate. And so that was how I got my start, of course, in the field, and just tumbled really upon the administrative role. And once I was in an administrative role, I found that I actually enjoyed it and I had a knack for it. Plus, it was getting a little bit harder to plie and releve every morning. As you know, dancers don't have a very, very long life.
They're a little like athletes in that regard.
A little bit.
Then they moved to teaching. Modern classical?
Originally, it was classical, ballet, and a little bit of flamenco as well. Ooh. And then around my mid-20s, I started delving into modern dance and just really loved it. And a whole new world opened up for me with the modern dance. And so it really was wonderful to have all of those areas of the dance field. And so my degree, I have a BFA in theater and dance. And when I say dance, it was most specifically contemporary dance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was your first administrative adventure? Were you working with a company that said, oh, dear, we need somebody to raise some money, we need somebody to keep our books, or how did that happen?
It was actually during my college years that we did have a touring dance company in college, and I just stepped up to do some fundraising and also take a lead role in the college dance department. We had a group of dance department students that we took trips together and like ADF, American Dance Festival, and we did several trips like that. So we had to fundraise a little bit for that. I mean, the university helped, but we had to fundraise a little bit for that. So that was I guess my first leadership role in the arts administration. But literally when I was working as a dance teacher, and I was actually working This was after graduation. I was actually working as a dance professor at the university, and this job opening became available. This position became available, and I just applied. I really never, actually, I was encouraged to apply. I never thought that it was something I could do, but I was encouraged to apply, and I did. And to my surprise, I ended up with a job.
Congratulations, you're an arts administrator.
And that's true. I mean, that's funny that you say that, but it's true. It was like that. Congratulations. Now you're an arts administrator, and you really had to learn a lot of the job on the job. Again, because there weren't college courses that said, you know, this is how you do arts fundraising or arts marketing or public relations. I mean, it was just something you learned on the job.
What would you say, obviously someone who encouraged you to apply for that first full-time arts admin professional job saw some personality characteristics in you. What would you say to, we do have a lot of young listeners who might be thinking about a college major or thinking about their career. What would you say the most important personality traits are to do something along the nature of run a performing arts center?
I would say flexibility is important, but I guess that's the case for any position of leadership, is to be flexible and open-minded. That certainly served me well in my career, and transparency. And I think that's very important, to be transparent in all that you do.
For someone who doesn't know, what might be too young to know what that means yet, what does that mean?
Transparency in everything that you do, so not holding back information. Most arts organizations, we're talking about the nonprofit arts world, and so for most of the nonprofits I've been involved with, you have a board of directors, and it's very important to be honest with your board of directors. And even when the news is not great news, it's very important to share the realities with your board of directors and also with your staff. So as the leader of the organization, you're sort of sandwiched between your board of directors and your staff. And it's very important that you're always transparent, that you're always telling the truth, because at the end of the day, it's going to come out.
And they can't help you if they don't know what's going
on. That's exactly right. And there is a sense of a team, and if everybody knows what's on the table, even when it is bad news, even when the organization is in crisis, everybody can come together as a team to solve the problem. And also, a lot of times leaders feel like they have to solve all the problems on their own. They have to be the heroes. They have to be the one that wear the cape. But that's not really the case. I think it is a team effort. And I believe in leadership as a team effort.
Now, you were obviously thriving at the Germantown Performing Arts Center. Were you just ready for a change, or what intrigued you about this position?
I was ready for a change. I made a conscious choice to leave that position because I wanted a new challenge. So on June 14th, and I remember this day, June 14th of 2011, because it was a day that I returned to the United States from China. I had been in China for 17 days on a tour with a youth orchestra that I founded 3 years, 2 years earlier. And so the day I returned from that tour, I made a decision that I needed to move on. And it was basically because of the fact that I felt I had gotten to a place where I had achieved a number of things in Germantown and had probably taken the organization as far as I could take it. We had tripled our programming. We had erased a deficit, created a reserve fund, increased our education programs by 279% over a five-year period. We had completed a strategic plan and completed all of its goals, reached all of the goals in 2 years instead of five. So we went back and redid the strategic plan. And we had diversified our board and our patron base, increased contributions and corporate giving. So I just felt we had done so much to move the organization forward. It was time for me to move on. And so what's really, I think, serendipitous is that on June 14th of 2012 was the press conference here where it was announced that I was taking the position. So a year to the date that I had made that decision. But it was because I personally needed a new challenge in my life.
I think there might be some sort of alert on your smartphone for June 14th of 2013. There might be some expectation of some big announcement.
Perhaps.
No pressure or anything. So obviously, I'm not going to put you on the spot by asking you which sorts of acts or gigs are your favorite at the Center for the Performing Arts. They're all your children. All your children have to be equally beautiful. But when you do have a little bit of time to indulge in hobbies or pastimes, are you still dancing?
I do not dance anymore. And what's interesting is that I do not miss not dancing. I do not miss dancing. I think I did, I'm pretty good about moving on when in leaving the past in the past.
Sure.
And, that has served me well in my personal life and my professional life. And I danced, I choreographed, I taught, I did all of those things.
You checked
things.
All the boxes on that list. Yeah.
And it was a very rich period of time for me and one that I enjoyed tremendously. And so it's not something I miss. Now, I would love to have a little more time to exercise, and probably my exercise of choice would be to take a ballet class as opposed to, you know, running on a treadmill.
Sure.
But right now I don't have the time for that, and I plan to make time for that. As a matter of fact, at the Center for the Performing Arts, I'm hoping to start a wellness program, and just recently talked to the staff about that, and I have a few staff members who have volunteered to take the lead on that.
Fantastic. Well, we're delighted to welcome you to the community. Break a leg, that's what you say,
Thank
to
you.
Theater people and dancers.
That's right. Thank you.
And we look forward to many more conversations.
I appreciate your invitation. Thank you.
Share a gamble with Tanya Castroverde Moscalento, the new president and CEO of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I get a preview of the Indianapolis Opera's new season.
I'll get to chat with Michael Feinstein about his new book, The Gershwins and Me.
And I'll find out what's so cool about the James Dean exhibit at the Indiana State Museum. Plus, we'll have that calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? So please, listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.